Ross on the phone. You beauty, here we go. Play that special intro for him.
MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
He's on the phone. Dr. Ross Walker, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, mate, and hopefully you're a lot better.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you a question, some free advice here.
Please.
On Friday, I was really crook and went and had a PCR test. I'd done two rat tests, and they were both negative. So I went and did the PCR test, and they told me that they started last week doing both the COVID test, but you also, in the one test, get results for influenza and RSV, etc. So I got the results back, and I thought I would have had, you know, the flu. But the RSV, what is RSV, Ross?
Respiratory syncytial virus. It's yet another respiratory virus that's nowhere near as contagious as COVID or influenza, but it's still there and it still is a significant cause of respiratory infections, probably more so in children, but it happens in adults as well. There's also para-influenza you can get. There's a whole lot of different respiratory infections that one can get, and it's not always the flu or influenza. So when people say, I've got the flu, often they don't. Often they just have another respiratory tract infection. So really, influenza is a specific virus that gives you aches and pains everywhere. You feel dreadful. You might have a sore throat. You might have a severe headache. And often with influenza A especially, which is the worst one of the two, influenza A versus B, there is a C, but A and B are the common ones in humans. Influenza A can also wipe out your gastrointestinal tract. I mean, without wishing to sound indelicate around lunchtime, about 13, 14 years ago, 1 week after I had a general anaesthetic to have my Achilles tendon repaired when I snapped it playing soccer, I developed influenza A, and I was having diarrhea 20 times a day. I was as sick as a dog. I actually felt I was going to die. I was that sick. It was so bad. Influenza A is a dreadful, dreadful illness, and it lasted for 2 or 3 weeks, and I was still having gut upsets for another 6 weeks afterwards. So influenza should not be demeaned, but it also shouldn't be overdiagnosed just because you got a bit of a sore throat.
So everything came back negative. So I thought to myself, well, obviously I've got one of the other ones that you've talked about this afternoon.
Sure.
With the same sort of symptoms of, you know, the sore throat, the cough, the runny nose, the headache, the aches, the fever, everything else.
Yeah, but it doesn't demean the fact that you were still sick. I mean, you still had a respiratory infection, and it's now settling, which is great. But it just means it wasn't influenza, it wasn't COVID, that's all. And it wasn't RSV.
Let's talk about monkeypox. Monkeypox virus. Is this the new pandemic? You've written an article about it. I mean, there's a story in, I think it was the Sydney Morning Herald about it today as well. 500 people, I think, is the number that was quoted in the article today, have now been diagnosed across the world with monkeypox.
And when I wrote that article, it was 172, and I wrote the article last Saturday morning.
There you go.
So you can see how quickly these things occur. But when you think about it, in a world population of getting close to 8 billion, going from 172 to 500 over 4 or 5 days is not much. That's not what happens with a pandemic. And so this is a moderately contagious disease. It's usually it's caught from skin contact, maybe from respiratory droplets as well, and maybe even sexual contact, because this is happening more in the gay, I'm not sure how we can terminology anymore, but in the gay population, typically men who sleep with men, that they're the population who are seemingly getting this. It's typically a very mild illness, apart from the fact the typical fevers, headaches, feeling aches and pains everywhere. But the interesting thing is they get a skin rash that's a bit like chicken pox. Starts in the mouth, they get the poxy lesions on their skin, and it spreads to the rest of the body after that. And it's called monkey pox because it started in monkeys in the Congo in the 50s. And there's been human outbreaks since the 70s. It's endemic in the Congo area and in parts of West Africa or Central Africa. But it hasn't really spread to the rest of the world until this particular outbreak. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be the vicious pandemic that we've seen with COVID. And also there are medications that are already effective for this if you've been vaccinated against smallpox, because monkeypox is part of the orthopox family, which has smallpox, cowpox, and monkeypox in it. So if you've been vaccinated against smallpox years ago, you have about 85% protection against monkeypox, there are more targeted vaccinations against monkeypox. They're not widespread available, but they're still there. And if we see one area is going to have a whole of the outbreak there, we'll vaccinate close contacts. But the disturbing thing about monkeypox, it has an incubation period of anywhere between 5 to 21 days. So if you know someone's had it, you've still got to wait 21 days. They're talking about isolating people for 21 days. But should we be all rushing out and being vaccinated and being worried about this? I think absolutely not.
Okay, you answered my question, Rhino. Yep. Thank you. Yep. Speaking of vaccinated, current vaccines, we're told, great at stopping severe disease. But people can still catch COVID-19 after 2, 3, or more shots.
Yeah.
We've seen many, many examples of that.
Sure.
Researchers hope a different delivery system will make for a vaccine that is better at preventing transmission and infections, and it doesn't hurt.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt. This is the nasal vaccine or the patch, the micro patch on the arm. And this is going to surprise you, Brent, but you'd think a needle would be more effective than these things. But it's not. In fact, the best vaccine delivery is to where the disease gets in. So if you spray something up someone's nose, that's how the virus enters the body, through the nasal passages. So they're getting much better local immunity and protection by doing that. And that's just what all the studies are showing in animals and in the limited human studies that have been done. And interestingly, the micro patch on the arm gives you better immunity than does an injection. And you say, well, hang on a minute, why aren't we already using nasal vaccines or micropatch vaccines? The micropatch vaccines, because they're incredibly expensive to produce, whereas the injectable vaccines are as cheap as chips. And that's the reason they haven't been wound out yet. But as we know, when mobile phones came out of the market years ago, they were about $2,000 or $3,000 for a phone, and now they're much cheaper. And exactly the same is going to happen when we get a better way of manufacturing these micro patches or the nasal vaccines. So I think vaccines are going to be moving to either nasal vaccines or micro patch over the next year or two.
Do you see that as a permanency, whereby instead of having a flu vaccine in years to come, you'll have a patch or you'll have something up the nose?
Absolutely. And also researchers are working on a universal flu vaccine and a universal COVID vaccine, because at the moment they keep changing the vaccine based on the bug. So influenza keeps changing and mutating every year to become a different version of influenza. But there are still basic features that make influenza, that make all coronaviruses, whether we're talking about COVID-19 or whether we're talking about the weak coronavirus that causes the common cold, a third of the common cold, or whether we're talking about SARS or MERS, there are still bits that make them coronaviruses. And so what they're trying to do is develop a vaccine against that bit, not against the spike protein or the different, what we call the hemagglutinin proteins in the influenza vaccine. So they're trying to find a more common feature for all of them, so that they can just give you this maybe once every 10 years as a patch or up your nose, so to speak.
That'd be good.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with medical things, but in a way it is. There's winners, there's losers in all sorts of things in reference to pandemics. Did you see the story of the first importers of these rapid antigen tests in Australia were in WA,
yeah,
and they have just paid $16.5 million for a new home. It is Perth's most expensive home ever bought, and this is because of the importation of the rapid antigen test. So someone's done okay out of it, haven't they?
Yeah, so who says rats aren't good?
Absolutely right. People with diabetes were almost twice as likely to die with COVID, they say. And the headline says diabetes almost doubles the risk of death from COVID. So people with diabetes were almost twice as likely to die with COVID and almost three times as likely to be critically or severely ill compared to those without diabetes. But there's a study, isn't there? Tell us about this study.
Yeah, the study was actually a compilation of 158 studies where they looked at 270,000 people around the world who developed COVID and found exactly what you're saying. Double the risk of death, three times the risk of critical illness, which means making it to intensive care or on a ventilator. And so all it's saying is that if you're a diabetic, you should beware, because you're at more risk for getting COVID and getting serious COVID. But the study also said, at a positive note, the better control you have over your diabetes, the more you control your weight, your eating habits, and get your sugar levels under reasonable control, the less severe the COVID was in your case. So there is a positive lining to all this.
All right. I'm looking forward to Body of Evidence today with Dr. Ross Walker. Body of Evidence today is, can you feel your blood pressure rising?
Well, let me tell you why this question came up. I received this rather bizarre letter from this gentleman who didn't even put his name to the letter. It could have been a lady, in fact.
Don't you love those?
and sort of abusing me, saying that doctors don't know what they're talking about. People can feel their blood pressure. And this is the egocentricity of human beings. If it happens to you, it happens to everybody. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to talk about how many people actually do feel their blood pressure? And it's estimated maybe about 20% of people, when they feel stressed and they feel their blood pressure going up and they check their blood pressure, they do feel full in the head. So I'd say to you, one in five people will experience a degree of rise in their blood pressure. But interestingly, some people have much more sensitivity in their blood vessels. And so, for example, there's the typical invasive coronary angiogram where you squirt dye down the coronary arteries. Now, the vast majority of people don't feel that at all when you squirt the dye. But about 1% to 2% of people actually feel the injection. So it's not a needle. They feel the dye being flushed down their arteries. They can tell you it's happening to them. Right. Other people, if you put catheters in the vascular system, when the catheters go into the right atrium, right ventricle of the heart, they actually feel it. But that's hardly anybody feels those things. So the blood pressure, I think, yes, about 20% of people might feel that fullness in the head, maybe feel a tightness in their chest if their blood pressure goes very high, but most of us don't. Okay. So that was the reason for that body of evidence.
We're talking to Dr. Ross Walker this afternoon. We've got medical myth and medical news still to come.